morning. My name is Chuck Briga, number 2731. With me is Mr. Mike McCurdy, sitting at council table. We are here on a case that is going to present some unusual and first impression issues in Colorado relative to how you look at trusts and determine whether they are marital property. The first of those is that we have never had a case that we've ever found that deals with a GROT, a grantor retained annuity interest trust in Colorado. And that's our first impression. It deals almost exactly the opposite way a normal trust deals and how it goes towards its beneficiaries. We'll go through that in a minute. The second thing is the impact of the probate code, Uniform Probate Code, which was enacted July 1, 1995, and how that impacts future interests in Colorado for purposes of probate as well as divorce law. This is a case that will be of immense interest to divorce lawyers and the probate lawyers to determine how their trust can be impacted by what is the law in this case. The initial and primary issue in this case was the 03 GROT marital property on the date it was formed, May 22nd, 2003, as determined by the trial judge. We say to the court that it is clear under the Uniform Probate Code pronouncement that that is not property. And let me tell you the wording of that so I don't do it incorrectly. The statute says, 1511-702, that a future interest under the terms of a trust is contingent on a beneficiary's surviving the distribution date. That changes the law in Colorado for trusts created or reaffirmed after July 1, 1995.
Mr. Briga?
Yes, sir.
Wasn't that statute in effect at the time the Supreme Court decided Ballantyne?
They decided Ballantyne in 2001, but I'll tell you why it didn't apply. The Ballantyne Trust was a 1976 trust. It vested, according to the decision, in 1990. The new statute did not go into effect until 1995, July 1, on all trusts created after that time, or reaffirmed, which Ballantyne apparently was not. The Ballantyne law will not prevail today as to trusts created after that July 1, 1995 date, per the statute and then per Colorado 15 CRS 1511 701 through 707. What we have then is that the condition of that trust in its paragraph 4.1 of the grant trust, it says, upon satisfying certain conditions, I will leave the remainder to my living children. Therefore, it created that interest that would only become possessory when it was, in fact, terminated in 07.
Mr. Briga?
Yes, sir.
If I understand your argument today, you're saying that the statute, 1511-707, sort of legislatively overruled the analysis in Ballantyne, such that the same result would not obtain based on the different facts we have today versus the facts in Ballantyne.
That's right.
See, the problem I have is I don't think in your opening brief you never mentioned that statute, nor did you mention this argument that the statute had any impact on the Ballantyne case.
Yes, we had it not only in our findings of fact to the judge, but in both of our briefs.
Well, I'm looking at your table of authorities for your opening brief, and you don't cite that statute in your table of authorities.
Well, I'm sorry, I don't have that right with me, but...
I don't remember an argument that it would have vitiated the holding in Bellinson, or at least led to a different result.
Can I have them take a look what we...
Perhaps you had it in your... Sure, go ahead. Go ahead with your argument.
All right. Because what I find in that is the statute, the Uniform Probate Code statute, does change the analysis for any trust after the date of July 1, 1995. Did you find that? It's in our paragraph 73 of our findings, proposed findings to the court, and it's in our page 19. Is that the plans? Well, the opening brief is on page 19. And on the reply brief, it's in page 33.
Perhaps I have a different opening brief than you're looking at. On page 19 of the opening brief I have, there's no mention of that statute. Maybe I know, was there an amended opening brief filed?
That was on the other side.
I think I can clarify this. When you talk about the Uniform Probate Code, which is referred to on page 19, what you're saying is that that provision has been adopted in Colorado as 1511-707.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
But you didn't say that in your opening brief.
That it was adopted?
Yeah, nor did you give the statutory site where it was adopted. Go ahead with your argument.
Okay. And in as a result of this statute, and it appears that Bellinson did not have any application to it because it was a 1990 vested trust. Therefore, in our case, this GRAW is not vested and was not vested for that reason of survivorship.
All right, let me see if I understand. So you're saying that any time the trust is contingent, then it is not vested. Is that what you're... Because in your brief, you say this appears to create a rule of law, and then you cite no authority for this proposition that if it's contingent, it's necessarily not vested.
Yes, that the comments to the UPC say that as a result of this, it is not vested. That's the comments to the UPC in there. And then later on, we find in the book which we cited, Mr. Chorney, one of their experts, he says that the Bellinson case would no longer be vested as a result of this UPC.
All right, but we don't care what experts have to say about
You're
the law.
I don't blame But okay. But anyway, and not only that, but this trust was not a marital property trust itself because of several other reasons. Now, let me go back to balance in a minute, though, can I? And that is to say that what it decided, because as you know, in balance, the court said the requirement that a beneficiary survive the term of the trust in order to receive a distribution and not render a future interest non-vested. So Bellinson says just the opposite of what UPC and our statute says now, but it only affects those trusts which were before 1995.
Mr. Bigger, help me out. Why do we care in interpreting the definition of property for the dissolution statutes, what the Uniform Probate Code says? Did Bellinson suggest that would be relevant, or does any other case suggest it's relevant?
Well, Bellinson doesn't even talk about it.
Well, generally, did Bellinson look to probate law generally to inform its analysis?
That there's no case that we have ever found that recited the Uniform UPC and or this statute 1511-707.
Right, so let me just restate my question because I don't think I asked it very clearly. Why should we look to the Uniform Probate Code to inform our analysis of what constitutes property under the marriage statute?
Well, here's what I would say. I would say that if you look at the Bellinson case and you find that the remainder interest is vested, which the Bellinson case does, some lawyer was probably guilty of malpractice in preparing that trust, because what happens, that settlor didn't intend for the beneficiary's ex-wife or husband to receive any of his trust. And that's why probate lawyers are very interested in this. And divorce lawyers are very interested in this because the law should be the same. We shouldn't have a separate law for division of property about trust and a separate law for probate lawyers. who do their estate planning, and it is non-vested for them, but it's vested for us. Somewhere there's a conflict with that that should be resolved, and this court has the opportunity to resolve it for trust after 1995. But this trust was also modifiable under paragraph 2.1, and 2.1 of the provision where it says it is modified. Also then, you relate that back to 14.10.113, paragraph 7, which is, as you know, the anti-Gorman statute section of that, which says that a trust that is modifiable is not vested. It's vested means that it's proper. That's what I would say, that's what it means under that thing. We also have an analysis here that there was no way anybody could do what the law requires in divorce, and that is fair market value of an asset. Nobody even tried to value the trust at the day they put the stock in.
Well, now, for tax purposes, they gave it a value. The mom had a certain value allocated to her share, right. The dad had. So why wouldn't that be a reasonable source for the trial court to rely upon?
Well, that's all the court had, but I don't think that makes it a fair market value report. Now, the judge, as you know, can use discretion finding what he wants to find if there's evidence. But in this case, I don't believe there was any evidence of anything. It was suggested.
Did the husband have the opportunity to put on evidence of what the property should have been valued with as of 2003? And did husband put on that evidence?
No, because there wasn't any way to value it. Here's the trust works like this, as you probably know. He put in $6,300,000. The father put in that. He had to take out over the 4-year term. He had to take out 28%+ a year. Plus, that would be more than 100%. Plus, he had to take out an extra 4% a year, or 12% over the 4 years, because when the IRS grants you permission to do a grunt, they put inflation in it. So not only do you have to take everything out you put in, but they want you to have to take out whatever the inflation rate is over the 4-year period, so you're not benefiting from it in any way. Now, that's what happened in this case. So there is no way you could render a value on this. And besides that, if you look at paragraph 3.2 is a provision that says the settlor can take all of the money out, the income, over and above his annuity at the trust pleasure. That is the trustee, and he happened to be the trustee. So he could take it all out. But I think if you looked at balancing three and you looked at the Cardona case, you will find the decision there that if there's no reasonable way to value this grot at that time, it is not property. And Cardona says it can be used for purposes of economic considerations in the divorce. Do I? I don't have much time, do I? I think I'll have to reserve the rest of my time. I didn't get to the 07 trust, which I wanted to do. But what I'd like to, and I'm curious about, is why it is that the opposing counsel has never brought up the Uniform Probate Code or 1511-707 in any of their briefs and cited why it didn't apply. Thank you.
You have just under a minute left for your very brief rebuttal. Mm-hmm. Response?
Pardon me, Your Honor, I didn't hear what you said.
You have just under a minute left for rebuttal. Just a minute.
Hey, please, the court. Good morning. My name is Mike Shirotis, 034-686, and I'm here on behalf of the appellee and cross-appellant Emily Milius. who is in the courtroom today with me. I also have at the counsel table Don Sisson, who has participated in the preparation of the case on the trial and appellate levels. As a preliminary matter, I will answer the question put by appellant's counsel, why they have not dealt with the United Probate Code, and the answer is that this is not a probate case, that this is a court of equity. It is a matter involving the domestic courts, which as opposed to probates are courts of equity and not courts of law, and that the probate cases by and large have to do with the rights of creditors, debtors and creditors, where no fiduciary relationship exists. And when dealing with marital partners, there is a fiduciary relationship between the partners involved, and thus a higher standard. And thus, there's no inconsistency for there to be one rule in the probate court and another rule in the domestic court, especially as limited to the question of whether certain assets are divisible at dissolution. I also would correct that and point out that the balance in the Free case was decided in 2005, not 2001. So it was decided subsequent to the probate code, and the balance in Three courts certainly had the opportunity to consider the probate court changes had they thought that they were at all relevant. Addressing appellant's point as regard vesting, the balance in Three court moved away from the word vesting as a test for whether trust interests constitute property, because the balance in Three court recognized that vesting can have different meanings in different contexts. Specifically, the court found that for purposes of the dissolution analysis, that an interest might be vested. In fact, the balance in two trust interests, the future interest in that case, was vested. Whereas, definitionally, if the definition of any condition subsequent renders an interest non-vested for probate purposes, that wasn't any sort of inherent contradiction. I believe that the analysis, contrary to the appellant, I think the analysis needs to begin with the 2007 trust and not the 2003, and that's because the 2007 trust was still existent at the time of the dissolution, and the mandates of the dissolution court is divide property as it exists on the date of dissolution. Looking at the 2007 trust, I think the relevant facts were largely uncontested or unchallenged by the appellant at trial or on appeal. The money used, the funds used to form the 2007 trust were the $67 million, which was distributed to father from his interest in the two grant retained annuity trusts from 2003. The $67 million between 2007 and 2012, when the court divided those assets, increased in value from $67 million to some $12 million. And the court also made certain factual findings regarding the circumstances surrounding the creation of that trust by husband.
Mr. Schrodes, sorry to interrupt you, but I want to get back to your point that you thought that we should start with the 2007 trust rather than the Gratz. And a reason why that confuses me a little bit is my understanding of the trial court's order was that the reason, or at least one reason why the trial court found the 2007 trust to be marital property is because the court believed it was funded by marital property. And in order to reach that conclusion, he had to do some analysis about when the grants were gifted.
I agree with Your Honor, but the reason I would say we start with the 2007, because if it's found that for some reason the 2007, the assets in the 2007 trust were not divisible, we don't really need to reach the earlier issue.
Okay, thank you.
The trial court also adopted as factual findings the terms of the trust, the 2007 self-settled trust itself. It accepted the trust document into evidence and adopted the terms of the trust as factual findings. Based upon the findings, the trial court appropriately found that the funds in the 2007 trust were subject to division at dissolution. And it's important to recognize that there might have been two independent bases upon which this finding could be predicated. One has to do with the nature of the trust interest itself. In other words, if the interest retained in the 2007 trust by husband after its creation was of the type that is recognized as property under existing Colorado law, then that property is subject to division under 1410.113. Courts divide property that exists on the date of dissolution. But there is an alternative ground that even if the court found that the trust interest retained by husband after 2007 was not of a character that would normally be regarded as property under a traditional trust analysis, that the court can nonetheless divide those assets under equitable principles. That if the circumstances of the trust were such that its creation was done, it was not a bona fide transfer, and even if it wasn't a trust at all, even if the husband in this case had just taken $6 to $7 million and given it to his dad and said, hey, dad, hold on to this until after the divorce and give it back to me at the end, the court has the ability under its equitable rationale and equitable powers to divide those assets at dissolution.
But Mr. Schwartz, if the court was going to go that route, the last route, wouldn't it have to make relatively specific findings to support basically dissipation of marital assets?
Yes, and I believe it did.
Well, what are those findings? Help me out.
I think the findings in this court were the findings that the trust was created at a time of marital discord, marked by excessive drinking by husband and domestic violence, that the trust was created at a time when the parties were living separately, and most importantly, the fact that husband was never able to offer evidence at trial that overcame wife's testimony that she didn't know about the trust when it was created.
But simply because she doesn't know about it, does that establish dissipation? Is that?
I believe it does. I believe that is knowledge of the trust creation, knowledge that a marital partner who is in a fiduciary relationship is removing millions of dollars in assets and setting them aside into a trust that either constitutes property or doesn't. I believe that is necessary for it to be a bona fide transaction. The Collada case refers to the earlier case law established the court's equitable powers and the equitable remedies in this situation, and they talk about it has to be a bona fide and not colorable transaction. And I believe that at bare minimum, for a transaction of this nature to be bona fide, it has to be done with knowledge and consent. I think knowledge itself is probably insufficient, because in this case, the husband could have said, hey, you know what, wife, I'm doing this, I'm moving the money, too bad, so sad, you can't do anything about it. And I think if those were the facts, knowledge itself wouldn't be sufficient. But
sufficient to establish dissipation, you mean?
I believe that to establish a bona fide transaction, in order to establish a bona fide transaction involving a unilateral transaction taking place during a marriage, the party conducting the transaction has to prove that it was bona fide and that it was done at minimum with knowledge and consent. I think without those things, it was as found colatic or fraudulent or illusory as against the interests of the other marital partner. And I believe the findings in this case, the specific findings and the extent to which the court took the time to make those findings in interim, it forms the foundation for the equitable relief in this case, regardless of the nature of the trust interest in 2007. However, I also think that this trust is divisible under either grounds, meaning I believe it's divisible under equitable principles due to the facts surrounding the formation, and I also believe it's divisible because it is property under traditional analysis. This is a self-settled trust, which means it's a trust that husband created himself. He is both ends of this transaction. He is the settler of the property, and he's also the person whom the property is supposed to benefit after the trust formation. The only third party involved is husband's father, who is hardly third party neutral. And he is a friendly partner.
Didn't the settler also intend to benefit the remainder beneficiaries, which were his descendants? That seems to be what the trial court was thinking as well.
Yes, to the extent that the husband wanted to keep the assets in his estate and in his control, either falling to him or his descendants.
Because the husband didn't have any right to demand distributions of income or principal.
He had limited rights. He could demand distributions for the purposes of payment of taxes.
Okay.
And the reason he could demand those distributions, because under IRS law, his interest in the 2007 trust was property. He is considered the owner of that property under IRS law and under a general principle of trust analysis. Whenever you have a settler who is both the settler and a beneficiary, and whenever you have a trust that is amendable or revocable, that trust is considered the property of the settlor slash beneficiary.
But does it matter that he couldn't revoke it unilaterally, that he had to have the consent of the trustee?
Not to the IRS. To the IRS, they recognize that when the trustee is not an independent third party, but is instead a family member or close party, that the asset is property of the beneficiary slash settlor and fully attachable to creditors both prior and subsequent.
Did the trial court make any findings about whether this trustee was adverse or non-adverse?
Pardon me, Your Honor.
You seem to be relying on the case law or the IRS provision, which talks about having a friendly trustee versus an adverse trustee. Did the trial court here make any findings about whether this trustee was adverse or non-adverse?
The trial court did not, but I don't believe the court, trial court needed to.
Counsel, you seem to be suggesting, well, you are suggesting, that we can look to tax law to determine whether this is property or not, that, in fact, the court did so. If that's true, why can't we look to probate law?
I guess I'm not suggesting that the court either relied on tax law as determinative or...
Well, it considered it and, in fact, ultimately adopted, in effect, tax law in valuing the 2003 grads, so
I believe there's one has to look. It's not merely categorical. That is never fair to bring in law from other areas of law, and it's or always fair. I think it depends upon the rationale. I think in this case, the rationale of the IRS provision and the restatement of trust. It's not limited to IRS law that considers self-settled trusts that are revocable by their own terms or in conjunction with the trustee as property. That there's a very good reason for that, because they recognize that the trustee in cooperation or the trustee in cooperation, a friendly trustee in cooperation with the settlor can revoke the terms entirely and send the trust back to the settlor. That one way or the other, we know that there's only three people involved, a settlor, a trustee, and a beneficiary. The one thing we know is the trustee can't have it. And in this case, husband is both of the other parties. And so I think the rationale of the IRS holding applies here. And I think it's not binding on this court, but I think it's influential. And I also think, by the way, that even under the holdings of the domestic court, that this court is, or that this trust interest is divisible as a trust, as property, based upon A, the fact that it's revocable, B, the fact that distributions can be demanded, and C, that the fact that the trustee does not have discretion to completely divest the beneficiary of the benefit of those assets. I think the relevance of the 2003 trust is in the valuation question, because I think having established that the interest in the 2007 trust is a property interest, either on equitable principles or based upon the nature of the interest itself, the question becomes, what portion of that $12 million, if any, is separate? And the starting point of this analysis has to be the presumption of marital property. In other words, under Colorado law, all assets in place at the time of dissolution are presumptively marital. Therefore, the $12 million was presumptively marital. The burden was on husband to prove why any portion of it was separate. Husband's argument in this regard was to say that the $6 to $7 million, which was distributed to him from his interest in the 2003 trust, was a gift from his parents in 2007, and therefore that $6 to $7 million was his separate property. The problem is that this is completely at odds with the facts. The facts are that husband's remainder interest, called technically a fully distributable remainder interest, attached in 2003 when the 2003 grants were created by his parents. This was in the nature of a future interest. Yes, husband at that time did not have the right to possess the remainder. In fact, there wasn't a remainder on the date that the trust was created based upon the way a grant works. The way a grant works, as described by counsel, is a settlor puts in property, and over the term of that, the term of the grant takes out the original grant of property in addition to interest. Therefore, on the date that the interest was given, it had negligible value. But that fact is not relevant to the inquiry. The fact that an interest is not possessory does not render it not property. That was made clear by the balancing analysis and reaffirmed later in the Dale case, where it said Colorado courts specifically rejected the argument that the fact that an interest in property, a future interest, is not present possessory. And in fact, that's as it should be, because by definition, logically speaking, a future interest isn't going to be present possessory. It's something that you're not going to have in the future. The Colorado courts recognize future interests in all sorts of different categories, not just with trusts. We recognize them in the area of pensions. We recognize them in the area of royalties. We recognize them in the area of stock options. And the fact that there are subsequent conditions that would render these interests or would result in these future interests not being worth anything does not undermine convert them to the status of not being property. Finally, as regards to the adoption of value, it was not fair for the court to adopt the valuation of the gift at the value placed upon it by the givers of the gift. I see that I'm out of time.
Your time is up.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Very briefly, Mr. Briga.
I'm going to do my best here. One of the things I wanted to mention to you was, I think you should look at paragraph 4.5 of the graph. That paragraph is identical to the paragraph in the 07 trust relative to the settlor not having to give money to the beneficiary for numbers of reasons. And even in the 03 trust, it talks about marital discord, and that is in all four children's trust is the same language. So that seems to me to be some significance. They also mentioned, if you look at, I know you've examined balance and three, that case talked about why we need to follow the legislative enactments, because they, and I put this down, they clarify and resolve pre-existing issues that apply in resolutions and dissolution cases. That balance and three. Am I done?
Yes, you're
done.
Thank
you very much for your time.
Thank you both for your fine arguments. The case is now deemed submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.